This is a When Walls Can Talk network podcast.
This episode contains graphic and extreme violence and sexual assault done to a child and may be extremely distressing to some listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
It's a frigid December morning in Boulder, Colorado. The world outside is veiled in a shroud of white, the remnants of a Christmas snowfall. The sun, a distant pale orb, struggles to pierce the gray skies, its light barely touching the Ramsey's Tudor-style home nestled in a quiet neighborhood. Inside, the house is silent, save for the muffled sound of footsteps on plush carpet. It's the day after Christmas, a home that should be echoing with the laughter of a six-year-old, and the warmth of family gatherings now holds a different story. In the dim light of dawn, a figure descends the staircase, footsteps hesitant. The air is thick with an unspoken dread, a prelude to a discovery that will shatter the stillness of this winter morning. As the figure reaches the bottom of the staircase, something catches the eye. Three pieces of paper lying in wait. It's a ransom note. Words scrawled in haste, a message that chills the bone. And upstairs, a bedroom lies empty. This is where our story begins. At the precipice of an unsolved mystery that has haunted us for decades. The story of JonBenet Ramsey, a beauty queen whose life was snatched away, leaving behind a trail of questions, a family torn apart, and a nation grappling with the incomprehensible. And in this silence, a thought lingers, persistent and probing. If these walls could talk. This age-old adage, the very inspiration for our show, resonates with a haunting truth in the Ramsey home. For within these walls lies the silent witness to a tale that has captivated and confounded us for years. Imagine if these walls could speak. What secrets would they unveil? Would they echo the laughter of a child now forever silent? Would they whisper the truths hidden beneath layers of paint and time? For within their embrace, they hold the final moments of a young life. The frantic heartbeats of a family torn asunder, and the shadowy presence of an unknown entity whose actions set this tragic story in motion. And yet, as we stand here at the threshold of the known and the unknown, we are reminded of the profound frustration. The walls remain silent, guardians of the truth, leaving us with only echoes and theories, some grounded in reality, others spiraling into the realm of the absurd. This is why we delve into this story. Unsolved mysteries like JonBenet's linger in the air like restless ghosts, haunting us with their unanswered questions, their unresolved endings. They compel us to look closer, to listen harder, to seek the truth in the silence. In this episode, as we navigate the labyrinth of this enduring mystery, we do so with the hope that, by giving voice to these silent echoes, by peering through the veil of the unseen, we might come a step closer to understanding, to finding peace in the unknown. For it is in the pursuit of these elusive truths that we find the very essence of our quest, the very soul of When Walls Can Talk. Throughout the ages, man has repeated the same earnest saying, more of a question really, or perhaps even a plea, if these walls could talk. But what if they do, and always have? Perhaps their stories, memories, and messages are all around us, if only we would take the moment to listen. On this podcast, we reinvestigate legends and tales of the past and allow the echoes of their lessons to live on once again, informing us, educating us, and sharing new and unique insight into the inner workings of the paranormal and spiritual world. Will you dare to listen? This is When Walls Can Talk, the podcast. In 1990, in a bustling Atlanta hospital, a baby girl was born. JonBenet Ramsey. Her name, a unique blend of her father's first and middle names, hinted at a life intertwined with her parents' aspirations. The family moved to Boulder, Colorado when she was just 9 months old to expand her father's software company. Now, Boulder was a haven for young families at the time, a place where dreams seemed just within reach. And for the Ramseys, those dreams were tinged with beauty and ambition. With a second home, boat, and private plane, JonBenet was brought up in a significantly glamorous life. But tragedy was forever stalking them like a hungry wolf. By 1994, John's eldest daughter, Beth, had been killed in a car crash. JonBenet's mother, Patsy, was a former Miss West Virginia from 1977, noisy and extroverted. Patsy's world was one where appearance mattered, where poise and beauty held extreme value. And Patsy, having battled ovarian cancer, seemed to pour her energy into her daughter's life with an intensity that only someone who has faced mortality can. You have to wonder, was it just about creating memories, or was it something more? Did she see in JonBenet a chance to relive her own pageant days, or maybe to achieve something she hadn't? In nearly everyone's lives, there are threads of regret, moments that, in hindsight, seem laden with foreboding. John and Patsy Ramsey spoke of mistakes they made during their time there. It's a vague and haunting admission. What exactly did they mean? And how does this tie into the narrative of JonBenet's life and the tragedy that befell her? One such instance takes us back to a time before the headlines, before the sorrow. JonBenet was just 3 and a half when the family attended a reunion for the Miss West Virginia pageantry system. Patsy, a former Miss West Virginia herself, brought her family into a world she knew well. It was there that JonBenet, wide-eyed and captivated, first glimpsed the sparkle and allure of pageants. Imagine young JonBenet, barely more than a toddler, enchanted by the glitz and glamour surrounding her. She begged to be a part of this dazzling world. It's easy to picture, isn't it? A little girl drawn to the bright lights, the beautiful dresses, the attention. But looking back, John and Patsy might have seen this as a pivotal moment, the start of a journey that would place JonBenet in the public eye, a decision they perhaps came to question in later years. This moment of innocence, of a child's desire to emulate the beauty and grace she saw, takes on a different shade when viewed through the lens of what was to come. It's these decisions, seemingly inconsequential at the time, that John and Patsy later reflected on with a sense of remorse. What did they see in hindsight? Was it the exposure, the attention that they regretted? Or was it something deeper, a sense of a path that, once taken, led them to places they never intended to go? By 6 years old, JonBenet was a pageant regular, her smile lighting up stages, her presence larger than life. Yet those who knew her described her as a tomboy, someone who could switch from sequins and tiaras to jeans and sneakers. It's this duality about her that really fascinates me. The public persona and the private child. The world saw her dancing across stages in makeup and curls, but who was she really, away from the glitter and lights? Just days before the tragedy that would engulf her family and capture the attention of the nation, JonBenet Ramsey gave her final public performance. On December 22, 1996, at a local mall in the Denver area, JonBenet was seen singing at the Southwest Plaza Mall in Littleton, Colorado, performing Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree. This haunting last video of JonBenet showcases her beaming with the joy of performance, a stark contrast to the events that would soon follow. This moment, captured in time, shows JonBenet as the child she was, immersed in the innocence of a Christmas celebration, unaware of the darkness that lay just ahead. Then there's the Ramsey family dynamics. JonBenet's father, John, a successful businessman, seems almost like a background character in the pageant narrative. He later expressed regret over their involvement in pageants, saying he wished they never put JonBenet on display. It makes you pause and think. What did he see that worried him? Was it the unnaturalness of it all or the unwanted attention it brought? And Burke, JonBenet's brother, it's a powerful reminder of the bond they must have had and of the innocence lost, not just JonBenet's, but his too. He's a figure who's been scrutinized, pitied, and speculated about. But in the end, he's just a brother who lost his sister in the most tragic of ways. What strikes me about this story is not just the tragedy of JonBenet's death, but the life she lived. It's a life filled with contrasts, the public and the private, the joyous and the sorrowful. As we delve deeper into this case, we do so trying to understand not just the how and the why of her death, but the who of her life. Who was JonBenet Ramsey, beyond the pageant stages and the headlines? What can her life tell us about her untimely death? And maybe, just maybe by understanding JonBenet, the girl, we can come closer to understanding the mystery that ended her life. Imagine a picturesque community, the kind where neighbors greet each other, where kids play freely along tree-lined streets. This was the vision the Ramseys had in mind when they moved to their home on 15th Street in Boulder, Colorado. It's the kind of place where the word safety isn't just expected, it's a given. But as we've come to learn in this case, appearances can be deceiving, and a sense of safety can sometimes lead to unexpected vulnerabilities. John and Patsy Ramsey believed they had found a haven for their family. Boulder, with its serene landscapes and friendly faces, seemed like a world away from the chaos and dangers of bigger cities. Their home, a sprawling 7,000-square-foot Tudor, became a hub of activity, a place where doors were often found unlocked, a testament to the trust they placed in their community. It wasn't unusual for the many doors of their house to be left open, a sign of their open-hearted and trusting nature. And then there were the kids, JonBenet and Burke, whose laughter filled the halls of this large house. Friends coming and going, a constant parade of youthful energy and joy. It was a home where children felt free to be children, a place of comfort and security. But this idyllic scene harbors a haunting question. Did this very openness, this trust in the safety of their community, play a role in the tragedy that befell the Ramseys? It's a jarring thought. The idea that the comfort of your own home, a place where you feel most secure, could be the very thing that leaves you vulnerable. In the days leading up to the tragic murder of JonBenet Ramsey, her father, John Ramsey, had reasons to regret certain decisions that, in retrospect, may have contributed to making his family a target. One such decision was publicizing the success of his company, Access Graphics. A newspaper article titled, "Access Celebrates $1 Billion Mark," was published on December 21st, 1996, highlighting the company's achievement of exceeding $1 billion in sales. You can imagine it, can't you? A moment of triumph, a reason for pride for sure. But John Ramsey, years later, would reflect on this with a tinge of regret. He told reporters that that article was a huge mistake. His gut had told him it wasn't a good idea to publicize his success, but he overrode that instinct. Why? For pride, for his employees, and maybe a little bit for the neighbors? All innocent, if you ask me. But in doing so, he later wondered, did he inadvertently put a spotlight on his family? And then there's Patsy, JonBenet's mother. In the days leading up to Christmas, their home was abuzz with activity, beautifully decorated for the season. They opened their doors to an estimated 1,500 to 2,000 guests. Think about that number for a moment. It's a staggering amount of people moving in and out of their home, each a potential observer, each a potential threat in disguise. Patsy, too, later expressed regret about this, the vulnerability they didn't see behind the veil of holiday cheer. Did this open invitation inadvertently provide the perfect opportunity for someone with ill intent to take a closer look, to plan something unimaginable? These are the details that linger in the mind, the what-ifs that haunt. Could the very things the Ramseys celebrated, their success, their openness, their hospitality, have been the factors that led to tragedy? It's a chilling thought. The pride of a business milestone, the joy of sharing their festive home, turned into potential vulnerabilities. In this story, every detail, every decision, takes on a weight it was never meant to carry. And as we sift through these decisions, we can't help but wonder, what role, if any, did they play in the events that led to one of the most infamous murders in American history? Let's rewind to the Ramsey family's final Christmas, specifically starting on December 23rd, just 3 days before the tragedy. They hosted a children's party at their home, a scene that now feels like something from a different world. Imagine it. The house is alive with the sound of children's laughter, the air filled with the scent of gingerbread. JonBenet, along with a friend, had a special job at this party. They were in charge of hanging up the coats of arriving guests. It's a small detail, but it paints a picture of her as an active, involved child, integral to the fabric of the family's social life. Patsy Ramsey had organized gingerbread houses for the kids, and by all accounts, they were having a ball. But it's John Ramsey's description of JonBenet that sticks with me. He called her the spark plug of the family. It suggests energy, life, the thing that makes everything else work. And that was JonBenet, a little girl whose presence lit up the room. There's this one anecdote that John recalled about JonBenet.
The thing that I remember about her was that if I would frown, she would look at me and say, "Dad, I don't like that face." And I'd smile and she said, "That's better." It's just the way she was.
She loved her daddy. She loved her daddy. She was daddy's girl.
It's a poignant image, isn't it? In those words, we see not just a six-year-old child, but a vibrant personality. Someone who had an impact on those around her. Someone who could change the mood of a room with a simple phrase. This last Christmas event, with its joy and normalcy, stands in stark contrast to what was to come. It was a moment in time, one of the last where the Ramsey family could be just that, a family without the shadow of tragedy hanging over them. When we think of JonBenet, it's often as a victim, but in this scene, we see her as she was, a lively, loving child, the heartbeat of her family. And it's this image of her, the spark plug, that makes what happened next all the more heart-wrenching. Christmas Day, 1996. It's a scene right out of a holiday card. The Ramsey family home, alive with the excitement that only Christmas can bring to a child. John Ramsey remembers this morning vividly. The kids, JonBenet and Burke, woke up early, their eyes bright with anticipation. This was the kind of morning where family memories are made, the kind of morning you look back on with warmth and fondness. Among the gifts, there was one that stood out for JonBenet, a new bicycle. Imagine her delight, her eyes lighting up at the sight of it. And in the midst of this idyllic family scene, the final two photographs of JonBenet alive were taken. She's there, under the Christmas tree, radiant. The word that comes to mind when you see these photos is angelic. She's full of life, her whole future ahead of her. And yet there's a bittersweet tinge to these images now, a haunting reminder of what was about to be lost. But it's a particular memory from that morning that John Ramsey reflects on with deep regret. JonBenet, thrilled with her new bike, begged her father to take her for a ride around the block. He remembers telling her, "No, no, we don't have time." They were preparing to go to a friend's Christmas party, and there just wasn't a moment to spare. She pleaded, but he held firm. Now, looking back, John talks about how this decision haunts him. It was another moment of what if, a seemingly small choice that, in hindsight, carries an unimaginable weight. For John, it's not just the loss of his daughter that he mourns, but also the loss of what could have been, the moments not taken. The moments we think are insignificant can become the ones we long for the most. And in this story of loss, the refusal of a simple bike ride takes on profound significance. A father's wish to turn back the clock for just one more moment of joy, one more chance to say yes. The evening of December 25th, 1996, the Ramseys returned from a Christmas party at a friend's house. It's around 9 p.m. They're in a bit of a hurry. There's a trip planned to Michigan the next day to visit John Ramsey's older children. The sense of urgency, the routine of getting the kids to bed, it's all so ordinary, yet underpinned by a tension they couldn't have anticipated. JonBenet is already asleep in the car when they arrive home. It's a familiar scene for any parent, the gentle, careful process of moving a sleeping child. John helps her out of her shoes, Patsy tucks her into bed. And then Patsy prays over JonBenet, a nightly ritual for her, reciting a familiar prayer. "Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. And if I die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take." It's a prayer that, in retrospect, sends a chill down your spine. It's the innocence and the unknowable future wrapped in those words that haunts. This night, according to Burke Ramsey, is also the last time he sees his sister alive. He's too excited to sleep, caught up in the thrill of a new model he'd received for Christmas. So there's John, sitting with his son in the living room, helping him assemble it. It's a simple moment of father-son bonding, yet overlaid with a sense of foreboding for what we, as the audience, know is about to happen. Finally, the house quiets down. John and Patsy, likely exhausted from the day's festivities, settle in for the night. They have no idea that these are the last few hours of normalcy they will ever experience as a family. As I sift through these details, the questions multiply. How did this evening of celebration turn into a nightmare? And why, among the twinkling lights and festive decor, did a shadow fall so heavily on this family's world? December 26th, 1996. It's the day after Christmas, a day that was supposed to be just another step in the Ramsey family's holiday plans. They were scheduled for an early morning flight at 7 a.m., heading to their second home in Michigan. Patsy Ramsey, likely moving through the routine of the morning with the efficiency of a practiced parent, comes to fetch some laundry from a cupboard near JonBenet's bedroom. Patsy glances at JonBenet's door, noticing it closed. At approximately 5:30 a.m., Patsy Ramsey descended the spiral staircase of their Boulder home. It was then she found something that would turn their world upside down. A ransom note lying on the staircase.
"Mr. Ramsey, listen carefully. We are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction. We do respect your business, but not the country that it serves. At this time, we have your daughter in our possession. She is safe and unharmed, and if you want her to see 1997, you must follow our instructions to the letter. You will withdraw $118,000 from your account. $100,000 will be in $100 bills, and the remaining $18,000 in $20 bills. I will call you between 8 and 10 a.m. tomorrow to instruct you on delivery. Any deviation of my instructions will result in the immediate execution of your daughter. Speaking to anyone about your situation, such as the police, FBI, etc., will result in your daughter being beheaded. If we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies. If you alert bank authorities, she dies. If the money is in any way marked or tampered with, she dies. You stand a 99% chance of killing your daughter if you try to outsmart us. Don't try to grow a brain, John. You are not the only fat cat around, so don't think that killing will be difficult. Don't underestimate us, John. Use that good southern common sense of yours. It is up to you now, John. Victory!
Now let's talk about this note. It's not just a brief, ominous message. It's a 2.5-page letter, verbose and specific, written on one of the Ramsey family's own notepads. The note demanded $118,000 for JonBenet's safe return, an amount eerily similar to John Ramsey's recent Christmas bonus. It's a detail that, to me and to many online sleuths, suggests the writer knew the Ramseys quite well. Or was it intentionally included to throw off investigators? The language of the note is peculiar. It starts with, "Mr. Ramsey, listen carefully," and then goes on to describe a small foreign faction having JonBenet. The tone is dramatic, almost theatrical, filled with movie-like phrases and an odd mix of politeness and threats. This lengthy note, written with a pen and pad from the Ramsey's own home, raised many questions. Why would a kidnapper take the time to write such an extensive note at the crime scene? And why use materials from the house? In the moment, Patsy's eyes catch the words, "We have your daughter." It's a line that no parent ever expects to read. A sentence that in a split second transforms everything from normalcy to sheer terror. In a state of panic, Patsy doesn't even read further. She's a mother, her instincts kicking in. She bounds back upstairs, throws open JonBenet's door, only to find her worst fears realized. JonBenet is nowhere to be seen. Patsy is frantic, her screams piercing the early morning silence, calling for John, who is still upstairs. John, upon hearing the terror in Patsy's voice, rushes down. He quickly reads through the ransom note, absorbing the horrifying reality that their daughter has been kidnapped. This moment, the discovery of the note, the realization of JonBenet's disappearance, is the point of no return. The Ramsey family's life, as they knew it, was irrevocably altered in those harrowing minutes. For John and Patsy, their home, once a haven of safety and joy, becomes the epicenter of an unimaginable nightmare.
911 emergency.
I'm with you. Police. What's going on? 515th Street.
What's going on there, ma'am?
We have a kidnapping.
Explain to me what's going on, okay?
There, we have a there's a note left and our daughter's gone.
A note was left and your daughter is gone? How old is your daughter?
6 years old. She's gone. 6 years old.
How long ago was this?
I don't know. I just found the note. And my daughter's gone.
Does it say who took her?
What?
Does it say who took her?
I don't know. There's a ransom note here.
It's a ransom note?
It says FBTC. victory. Please.
Okay, what's your name? Are you
Kathy Ramsey? I'm the mother. Oh my God! Please.
I'm sending an officer over. Okay.
Please.
Do you know how long she's been gone?
No, I don't. Please, we just got out, and she's right here. Oh my God! Please.
Okay.
Well, somebody.
I am, honey.
Please.
Take a deep breath.
Please.
Okay.
Hurry.
Kathy.
Within 7 minutes, which in situations like this must have felt like an eternity, a patrol car arrives at the scene. The response is quick, but what unfolds next only adds to the confusion and mystery. One patrol officer searches the house, including the basement. Another combs the area outside, noting something peculiar. No signs of forced entry, no footprints in the fresh snow. These details, or the lack thereof, are puzzling. It's as if the kidnapper vanished into thin air. Meanwhile, investigators are growing suspicious of the parents. They feel John and Patsy aren't acting as expected. How are parents supposed to act in such an unimaginable situation? It's a question that haunts this case. But what strikes the investigators as particularly odd is Patsy, still in the same clothes from the night before. To them, it's a red flag, a detail that doesn't fit the narrative of a typical kidnapping. As if this wasn't enough, friends and neighbors begin converging on the house. The scene is chaotic, people everywhere, one even starts cleaning the kitchen. This is not protocol, this is not how a crime scene should be managed. And then there's Burke, JonBenet's brother. He remains in his bedroom, a fact that investigators find unusual. He later says he was scared, a simple explanation, but in the context of the morning's events, everything is under scrutiny. With the kidnapper's supposed call looming, they were to give instructions on delivering the ransom somewhere between 8 and 11 a.m., the police tap the family's phone line. John, thinking like a businessman, calls his banker, managing to catch him before he leaves for a holiday. The ransom, $118,000, is prepared by 7:30 a.m. And Burke? He's sent to a friend's house, removed from the unfolding chaos. This part of the story is rife with oddities and questions. Did the lack of forced entry indicate an inside job? Why was Patsy still in her clothes from the night before? What about the lack of footprints outside, and the decision to clean the kitchen? Was this an act of kindness, or a contamination of evidence? Suspicion was starting to seep into the minds of the investigators. Patsy Ramsey, distraught and sobbing hysterically in the side sunroom, seemed to be watching every move the investigators made, peering through splayed fingers over her eyes. It's a detail that struck the officers as unusual. Was this the behavior of a grief-stricken mother, or something else? Then there was the interaction, or lack thereof, between John and Patsy. Observers noted that neither made an apparent attempt to console each other. In such a harrowing situation, you might expect a certain level of shared grief, a leaning on each other for support. But here, there was a distance, a detachment that raised eyebrows. The first detective to arrive on the scene was Linda Arndt. She was led into the house by John Ramsey, and what she observed left her deeply unsettled. John's behavior, his demeanor, it didn't seem to fit the situation. Was it shock, confusion, or something more? Arndt, an experienced officer, couldn't shake the feeling that something was off.
8:10 a.m., Arndt arrived at the Ramsey home and meets John Ramsey for the first time.
How did he strike you?
Cordial.
Cordial?
Mm-hmm.
Upset?
Cordial.
Distraught?
Cordial.
Did it strike you at all that he was
that was behavior that was unusual for somebody whose child was just kidnapped?
It's been my experience that people respond to trauma in different ways. So if someone has a response that is different from mine, I don't put judgment to it. I'll just note it.
In situations like these, every action, every reaction is scrutinized. The behavior of grieving parents is often hard to predict or understand, but in the Ramsey case, these behaviors became focal points for suspicion. The lack of physical comfort between John and Patsy, Patsy's seemingly contradictory actions of crying yet observing, John's unsettling behavior in the eyes of Detective Arndt, all of these elements combined to paint a picture of a family acting under unusual and suspicious circumstances. As the clock ticks towards 8 a.m. on December 26th, the house is tense, the air thick with anticipation. Everyone's focus is on the telephone. John Ramsey, script in hand provided by the investigators, is waiting for the ransom call that would instruct him on how to deliver the $118,000. The phone rings about half a dozen times, but each time it's someone else. There's no word from the alleged kidnappers. 10 a.m. came and went with no contact.
10 a.m., the deadline imposed by the writer of the ransom note for a telephone call.
10 o'clock comes and goes, and there's no acknowledgement within the house from anyone that the deadline imposed by the author of the ransom note has come and gone.
Nobody said it's 10 o'clock and the kidnappers haven't called?
Nobody said that.
1 o'clock p.m. Detective Linda Arndt, sensing John's escalating anxiety, suggests a task to occupy him. She asks him to search the home again, this time more thoroughly, searching for anything out of place. John, accompanied by a family friend, starts the grim task of going room by room, heading straight to the basement. He opens every door, checks every corner until finally, he opens the door to a small windowless room, often referred to as the wine cellar. What he finds there is a scene that no parent should ever have to witness. JonBenet is lying on the cold floor, covered by a white blanket. The sight is harrowing, the details stark and deeply unsettling. JonBenet's arms are bound above her head, her mouth covered with duct tape. It's a moment of pure horror, a realization of the worst fears any parent can imagine. John's reaction is instinctive, primal. He screams, a desperate attempt to get the attention of investigators upstairs. In a state of shock, he scoops up JonBenet's lifeless body and carries her upstairs to the main floor. The grief, the desperation in that moment, it's something that words can hardly capture. This discovery, this moment where hope turns to despair, where a missing child case becomes a murder investigation, it's a pivotal point in the story. It's where the narrative shifts dramatically, where the questions and suspicions start to multiply. In this moment, the Ramsey family's private tragedy becomes a public enigma, a case that would capture the nation's attention and spark debates and theories for years to come.
And I see John Ramsey carrying JonBenet up the last three steps from the basement. And my mind exploded. And everything that I had noted that morning that stuck out instantly made sense. and JonBenet was clearly dead. Then she's been dead for a while. I ordered him to put JonBenet down. I knelt next to her and I leaned down to her face. And John leaned down opposite me. And his face was just inches from mine. And we had a nonverbal exchange that I will never forget. And he asked if she was dead. And I said, yes, she's dead. And I told him to go back to the room and to dial 911. And as we looked at each other, I remember, and I wore a shoulder holster, tucking my gun right next to me and consciously counting, I've got 18 bullets.
Why did you do that?
Because I didn't know if we'd all be alive when people showed up. I said that everything made sense in that instance. And I knew what happened.
Do you think your fear was well-founded?
You bet I do. There's no doubt in my mind.
To this day?
Never wavered.
You were afraid because you thought the killer was still in the house.
I knew it.
Absolutely?
Absolutely.
In the aftermath of John Ramsey finding JonBenet's body, Detective Linda Arndt made a decision, one that would later become a point of intense scrutiny and criticism. She decided to move JonBenet's body from the hallway where John had placed it into the living room. This move, though perhaps made with intentions of preserving some semblance of dignity or privacy, would later be questioned for its impact on the crime scene's integrity. John Ramsey, following closely, is overtaken by a father's instinct to protect his child, even in death. He takes a throw blanket from the couch, covering JonBenet's body. In his mind, perhaps, it was a final act of care, of shielding her from the harsh reality of their situation. But this act of covering her body would further complicate the crime scene investigation. Detective Arndt's decisions, allowing John to search the house, which led to the discovery and movement of JonBenet's body, and then the subsequent covering of the body, were later met with harsh criticism. In the world of law enforcement, where preserving the integrity of a crime scene is paramount, these actions were seen as critical missteps. They potentially contaminated crucial evidence, altered the scene, and made the already daunting task of solving this case even more challenging.
You had to know that that was going to contaminate evidence.
JonBenet's body was in and of itself a crime scene. Would it be nice if John hadn't found JonBenet? Absolutely. And would it be nice if he hadn't put a blanket? Yeah, it would be great. And it would be nice if there were other people to help control and keep people away. That would have been wonderful. But that's not the circumstances that I had available that day.
And it's true. In the hours that followed the discovery of JonBenet's body, Detective Linda Arndt found herself in an almost unimaginable situation. Believe it or not, she was alone, the sole law enforcement officer still on the scene that had rapidly spiraled into chaos. Surrounding her were JonBenet's parents, the family pastor, and four family friends. Each person was grappling with a maelstrom of emotions, grief, shock, confusion. And Arndt, in the midst of this, was tasked with managing the scene, a responsibility that was both critical and overwhelming. Repeatedly, Arndt called for backup, reaching out for additional support in managing the situation. But her calls were met with an astonishing response. Everyone was in a meeting. This left her to navigate the complexities of the scene largely on her own, a scenario that any law enforcement officer would find daunting. The criticism that Arndt later faced was, in many ways, a reflection of the impossible circumstances she found herself in. Critics questioned her decisions, her management of the scene, but it's important to consider the context. She was alone, managing a house filled with distraught individuals, while also trying to preserve what was left of the crime scene. It was a balancing act of immense proportions, one that few could have managed flawlessly. It wasn't until 1:20 p.m., after 3 hours managing the scene of the kidnapping that had quickly become a homicide, and a full 20 minutes after JonBenet's body was discovered, that backup finally arrived. The evening of December 26th, JonBenet Ramsey's body was finally removed from the family home, marking the end of an unimaginably tragic day for the Ramseys. The family, in their state of shock and grief, was taken to stay with friends, away from the home that had turned into a crime scene. By the next morning, the case had already begun to leak into the public sphere. The Colorado Rocky Mountain News reported the murder in the morning newspaper with a tone of skepticism, already hinting that the case didn't add up. But it was the findings during the autopsy that morning that escalated suspicions further. The pathologist discovered that JonBenet had been sexually assaulted, garroted, and beaten at the time of her murder. Adding to the horror, the autopsy revealed signs of previous vaginal inflammation, leading investigators to the disturbing conclusion that she had been a victim of sexual abuse even before her tragic death. Perhaps the most chilling discovery was the extent of the physical trauma she had suffered. As her scalp was peeled back, the pathologist found an 8-inch-long fracture, spanning the entire length of her head. This grim detail painted a picture of the brutality of the attack, a piece of evidence that was as heart-wrenching as it was critical to understanding what had happened to her. In the days following the discovery of JonBenet's body, the Boulder Police Department's focus began to narrow sharply. It became clear that their primary suspects in this heinous crime were none other than JonBenet's own parents, John and Patsy Ramsey. This direction in the investigation stemmed from a growing belief among the police that the crime scene had been staged. The prevailing theory among investigators was that JonBenet had been hit over the head, resulting in the 8-inch skull fracture revealed during the autopsy. The police hypothesized that the rest of the crime scene, including the garrote and the ransom note, was part of an elaborate cover-up orchestrated by the parents. The ransom note, in particular, drew significant attention. The police began to suspect that it was written by Patsy Ramsey herself, using a pad and pen found in the family home. As these suspicions solidified, they quickly leaked to the press. The media coverage began to paint a picture of the Ramseys as prime suspects. One detail that was particularly seized upon was the fact that both John and Patsy had hired separate lawyers. To the public, fed by media speculation, this move was seen as an indication of guilt, a sign that they had something to hide. This period marked a crucial juncture in the case. The transition from a broad investigation to a focused scrutiny of the parents came with its own set of controversies and complications. The decision to hire lawyers, a common practice in legal matters of this magnitude, was interpreted through the lens of suspicion. In this unfolding narrative, the Ramseys found themselves not only grieving the loss of their daughter, but also fighting against a growing public perception of guilt. As the year 1996 drew to a close, the Ramsey family found themselves in the midst of a somber journey back to their roots in Atlanta. New Year's Eve, a time typically marked by celebration and hope, was for the Ramseys a day of profound sorrow. They were there to lay their daughter, JonBenet, to rest. The funeral was a poignant moment, marked not just by the grief of a family, but also the glaring spotlight of an increasingly hostile media and public caught up in the frenzy of the case. Family and friends found themselves in the unexpected role of protectors, shielding John, Patsy, and Burke from the intrusive eyes and lenses of the press. But the media storm surrounding the Ramseys was intensifying with each passing day. By January 1st, 1997, the pressure had reached a tipping point. The family, likely advised by their legal team and feeling the weight of public suspicion, made the decision to speak to the news. This wasn't just a family grieving anymore. They were now in the throes of a public relations battle, attempting to quell the storm that was gathering momentum against them.
You believe it's someone outside your home.
There is a killer on the loose. I don't know who it is. I don't know if it's a he or a she. But if I were a resident of Boulder, I will tell my friends to keep your babies close to you. There's someone out there.
This public statement was a critical moment in the narrative of the case. It was an attempt by the Ramseys to reclaim their story, to present their side amidst the growing clamor of suspicion and accusation. But in a situation as charged and complex as this, every word, even every expression, would be analyzed and interpreted, often through the lens of skepticism. In a CNN interview, Patsy Ramsey, through tears, urged the people of Boulder to be cautious, asserting that there was a killer on the loose. Her plea to keep your babies close to you was a mother's cry for vigilance. But this broadcast only served to bolster theories that the Ramseys were more interested in a public performance than cooperating with the police. The following day, Boulder Mayor Leslie Durgan publicly countered Patsy's claim in a press conference, stating that Boulder was safe and there was no need to fear a killer wandering the streets looking for children.
I have been asked frequently, is there widespread fear in Boulder? And the answer is no. And there is certainly no cause for that widespread fear. I want to assure the citizens of Boulder of two things. One of them is that I have complete confidence in the Boulder Police Department. And as we have said before, and I will say again, what we want out of this is not only to determine who the murderer was, but to get a conviction. And that will be the ultimate conclusion, successful conclusion of this case. And so I fully support the police department in doing whatever they need to preserve the integrity of this case so that we can achieve a successful conclusion. The second question that I have been asked frequently by the media, and frankly only once by a citizen, is whether there is a killer on the loose and do we need to take special precautions in the city. Certainly as parents, and I am one, we make sure that our children are safe, and we do that all the time, and I would expect parents to continue to do that. But I think that people in Boulder have no need to fear that there is someone wandering the streets of Boulder has been portrayed by some people, particularly in talk radio, looking for young children to attack. Boulder is safe. It's always been a safe community. It continues to be a safe community.
This statement, based on information from the police chief, was intended to allay community fears, but only deepened the Ramseys' dismay. They couldn't fathom why Mayor Durgan would downplay the danger when, to them, it was evident that JonBenet's killer was still at large. Meanwhile, the investigation was focusing more tightly on the Ramseys. Police leaks to the media highlighted the lack of footprints in the snow, suggesting no intruder had entered the house. There were claims that Patsy was only pretending to cry and that John had been absent from the home for about 50 minutes following the police's arrival, actions viewed with suspicion. Additionally, John's decision to have his private plane flown back to Atlanta following the murder was seen as peculiar, though the reason behind it remains unclear. As the Ramseys returned to Boulder to assist with the police investigation, staying with friends during this time, they found themselves increasingly isolated, both from their community and in the court of public opinion. Each action they took, each decision they made, was dissected under the unforgiving microscope of a case that had captured national attention. But the accusations had only just begun. Soon, videos of JonBenet's pageants were on every television screen in America, as people everywhere began to whisper that John and Patsy had sexualized their daughter and abused her. Newsweek and People magazine put her photos on the cover of their magazines. It was even on the cover of a magazine in London under the title The Kiddie Porn Killing. In his diary, John wrote of the excruciating experience.
"We keep our curtains closed and our doors and windows are locked. Going anywhere is a major planned and organized operation. We have people coming to the door claiming to have information helpful to the case, but they're actually tabloid reporters. Life is difficult to go on with. The burden is almost too heavy."
In their eyes, they had lost their daughter, and that's all that mattered. As the media frenzy around the JonBenet case escalated, some local reporters started to dig beneath the surface of the sensational headlines and police leaks. What they found was a trail of misinformation, leaks to local newspapers that, upon closer examination, didn't hold up. This discovery raised a new set of questions. Why were these false leads being fed to the media? What was the motive behind disseminating information that could be so easily discredited? One of the key details that had been reported widely was the absence of footprints in the snow around the Ramsey home, suggesting there was no intruder. However, it turned out there was no snow on the pathways that night. This revelation significantly altered the narrative, opening up the possibility that someone could have indeed entered the home without leaving footprints. Then there was the matter of the ransom note. Despite widespread speculation that Patsy Ramsey had written it, no handwriting expert has ever definitively concluded that she was the author. This key piece of evidence, which had been used to cast suspicion on the Ramseys, was suddenly not as incriminating as it had seemed. Furthermore, it was reported that John Ramsey had left the house that morning, and that he had arranged for his family to fly back to Atlanta immediately following the murder. Both of these claims were proven false. John had not left the house that morning, and the family did not immediately fly back to Atlanta, as reported. These discrepancies in the reporting and the investigation suggest a possible strategy to apply pressure to the Ramseys, perhaps in the hope that they would turn on each other. The spreading of misinformation, whether intentional or not, muddied the waters of an already complex investigation. For the Ramseys, these revelations must have been a mix of vindication and frustration. Vindication in that some of the most damning claims against them were proven false, and frustration at the realization that their portrayal in the media was shaped by inaccuracies and assumptions. In Boulder, District Attorney Alex Hunter was facing a mounting crisis of confidence in the police investigation. Amidst the swirling theories and public speculation, Hunter took a step back, scrutinizing the evidence, or more precisely, the lack thereof. He compiled a secret document, a list of critical items and evidence that the police had failed to explain, items that could potentially reshape the entire narrative of the case. First, there was the duct tape used to gag JonBenet. No matching tape was found anywhere in the Ramsey home. Then there was the nylon cord used to bind her. Again, nothing in the house matched it. And the paintbrush that was used for the garrote, used to pull the noose tighter around her neck. Well, part of it was missing, unaccounted for. And perhaps most perplexing of all, there was no sign of the murder weapon that had caused the catastrophic injury to JonBenet's head. If the killer had never left the home, as the police theory suggested, where were these items? With these unanswered questions looming large, Hunter realized he needed fresh eyes on the case, someone outside of the Boulder Police Department's echo chamber. He decided to bring in the best homicide detective he could find. After examining 80 candidates, he selected Lou Smith, a detective from Colorado Springs with a near-mythical reputation. Smith had investigated over 200 cases and solved 90 of them, a remarkable track record. As Smith began to delve into the case, the investigation, which had been teetering on the edge of becoming a cold case, was injected with new life. For the Boulder police and D.A. Hunter, Lou Smith's involvement was a chance to re-examine the evidence with a new lens, to question assumptions, and to potentially steer the investigation in a new direction. Lou Smith began his investigation by meticulously examining crime scene photos. It was a methodical process, one photo at a time, until one image stopped him in his tracks. This photo showed a basement window, wide open, a seemingly minor detail that had been overlooked, but to a detective like Smith, it was a potential breakthrough. Even more intriguing was the scuff mark on the wall beneath the window, leading directly to the floor below. Smith's attention to detail led him outside, to the exterior wall of the Ramsey house, where he discovered that the window was easily accessible and protected only by an unlocked metal grate. This discovery was compounded by another curious observation. Foliage, recently trapped beneath the lip of the grate, suggesting that the grate had been recently moved and then replaced, disturbing the plants in the surrounding garden bed. Further examination revealed that the ground at the bottom of the window well appeared disturbed. There were even marks along the window frame that could be interpreted as fingerprints. Inside the basement, a fresh shoe print was visible on a suitcase sitting beneath the window. And there was a shard of glass that might have been transferred from the bottom of a shoe. These were details that could not be easily ignored, pointing to the possibility of an intruder entering through this window. However, when this theory was presented to the public, skepticism was immediate. Many scoffed at the idea, arguing that the window well was too small for anyone to access the property through it. In response, Lou Smith took an unconventional step. He demonstrated for journalists on camera that even he could access the building through the window with relative ease. His demonstration was a powerful rebuttal to the skeptics, reigniting the intruder theory with newfound vigor. Lou Smith, undeterred by the skepticism he faced from some corners of the Boulder Police Department, continued to delve deeper into the evidence. His focus turned to a peculiar and unexplained aspect of the case: the strange marks found on JonBenet's back and face during her autopsy. These marks, which were not present in the photographs taken on Christmas morning, were a crucial piece of the puzzle. With the round, side-by-side marks, a theory began to form in his mind. The distance between the marks on both her back and face was consistent, suggesting they were made by a tool with two prongs. The only explanation that made sense to Smith was a stun gun. To test his theory, he compared the marks from a stun gun to those found on JonBenet and found that they matched precisely. Feeling confident in his findings, Smith presented his theory to a medical examiner, who even went on the record stating that he felt medically certain that the injuries were caused by a stun gun. This revelation, if true, had significant implications for the case. It effectively ruled out the parents as suspects. Why would they need a stun gun to take JonBenet from her bed or to cover up an accidental killing? Despite Smith's confidence in his findings, the Boulder police remained unconvinced. They dismissed the idea of a stun gun as preposterous and continued to downplay the theory of an intruder. Their response only added to the mounting concerns of Boulder District Attorney Alex Hunter. He worried about the fairness of the investigation, the seeming reluctance of the police to consider any alternative theories. But there's yet another twist that casts doubt on the Boulder Police Department's focus solely on the parents. It revolves around a critical piece of evidence, a spot of blood found on JonBenet's underwear. When the Boulder Police made a formal request for forensic testing, they described the case in the filings as a family killing, with John and Patsy Ramsey listed as the only and official suspects. The characterization of the case reflected a narrow focus on the investigation, one that seemed to preclude any other possibilities. However, the results of the DNA tests brought a startling revelation. Mixed with JonBenet's blood on the underwear was the DNA of an unknown male, a profile that did not match John Ramsey or any other family member. This discovery, made only days after the murder, was a game changer. It was conclusive evidence that someone else, an intruder, had been present in the house on the night of the murder. And here's where the story takes yet another perplexing turn. Despite the significance of this finding, the Boulder Police Department seemingly ignored it. Even more troubling, they didn't pass this critical information on to the district attorney's office for 7 months. This delay in sharing crucial evidence speaks volumes about the direction and focus of the investigation. For the district attorney and investigators like Lou Smith, who were open to the possibility of an intruder, this overlooked DNA evidence was both a vindication of their approach and a source of frustration. It highlighted a stark divide between the police and those who believed that the evidence pointed to someone outside the family. As the years passed, the JonBenet Ramsey case continued to be mired in controversy and conflict. The divide between the Boulder District Attorney's Office and the Boulder Police Department only deepened, each side holding firmly to its own theories and conclusions, insisting that each other was taking the case off course. This prolonged battle over the direction and focus of the investigation eventually led to the case being brought before a grand jury. The question at hand was a pivotal one. Could there be enough evidence to indict John and Patsy Ramsey for the murder of their daughter? After a thorough review, the grand jury and the district attorney's office reached a decision that would shape the future of the case. They concluded that the investigation, as it stood, did not have sufficient evidence to warrant a murder accusation against the Ramseys. This outcome was a significant moment in the saga, one that seemed to validate the concerns of those who believed in the Ramseys' innocence. In the aftermath of the grand jury's decisions, changes began to sweep through the investigative teams. One by one, the police officers who had worked on the case were reassigned to other projects, their roles in the Ramsey investigation coming to an end. The shifting of personnel signaled a turning point in the case, a recognition that the initial approach had not yielded the desired results. However, for Detective Lou Smith, the man who had tirelessly championed the intruder theory and sought to broaden the scope of the investigation, the pressure to conform to the prevailing narrative against the Ramseys became overwhelming. Faced with an investigation that seemed increasingly resistant to his findings and theories, even he reached a breaking point. Ultimately, Lou Smith made the difficult decision to resign from the case, a move that spoke volumes about the challenges and frustrations he faced within the investigation. But the turn of the millennium brought new developments in the John Ramsey case. In the year 2000, Boulder saw a change in its district attorney, and with this change came a renewed interest in solving the enduring mystery. Lou Smith, the staunch advocate of the intruder theory, was brought back on a part-time basis. Then, in 2002, a shocking secret memorandum came to light. This document listed suspects who had not yet been cleared in the JonBenet Ramsey case. It was a revelation that suggested the investigation was far from over, that there were still avenues and individuals that needed to be explored. Fast forward to 2008. The new Boulder DA, employing groundbreaking DNA techniques, made a significant announcement. John and Patsy Ramsey were officially exonerated, declared innocent of the crime that had taken their daughter's life. The moment was a turning point, a public acknowledgement of what some had believed all along, that the Ramseys were not responsible for JonBenet's death. But for Patsy Ramsey, this exoneration came too late. She had succumbed to ovarian cancer 2 years prior, never living to see her name cleared. John Ramsey, however, received a letter from Mary Lacey, the Boulder District Attorney, who apologized for the ordeal the family had endured. Lacey's words, quote, "No innocent person should have to endure such an extended trial in the court of public opinion," echoed a sentiment felt by many who had followed the case. This exoneration, though a relief to John Ramsey and a vindication of sorts, was bittersweet. The years of suspicion, the relentless media scrutiny, and the personal toll it had taken on the family could not be undone. The JonBenet Ramsey case remains a stark reminder of the complexities and challenges of high-profile criminal investigations, where the pursuit of justice is often fraught with obstacles, both legal and emotional, and where the truth can sometimes remain elusive, shrouded in the shadows of unanswered questions and perhaps police department reputation. But we're completely forgetting someone else. Someone who investigators and thousands of people online still to this day passionately believe could be behind the attack. JonBenet's 9-year-old brother, Burke. Weighing around 60 pounds at the time, Burke became a focal point for a theory that some investigators and many online theorists vehemently believed. The theory posited that, in a moment of rage or jealousy on Christmas night, Burke had struck his sister, leading to the catastrophic head injury. The rest of the crime scene, according to this theory, was staged by John and Patsy Ramsey in a desperate attempt to protect their son. Police first interviewed Burke just an hour after JonBenet's body was found, but before he had been informed of her death. The release of the interview transcript years later revealed that Burke was seemingly unaware of the tragedy that had unfolded. He appeared confused, innocent to the grim reality that his sister was gone. 2 weeks after the murder, Burke underwent a more formal interview with social services, which was also reviewed by a child psychologist independently. The scrutiny on Burke was intense, the pressure immense. Yet the conclusions drawn from these interviews and evaluations found no cause for concern. The child psychologist's assessment painted a picture of a family with healthy, caring relationships. There was no indication of jealousy or rage from Burke towards his sister, no signs that pointed to him as a perpetrator of such a violent act. Despite these findings, the theory implicating Burke persisted in some quarters, fueled by the public's fascination with the case and the proliferation of theories in the absence of clear answers. For Burke, this meant growing up under the shadow of suspicion, a child caught in the vortex of one of the most publicized and scrutinized murder investigations in recent history. If we entertain the notion, however briefly, that Burke was behind the attack, we are then forced with a significant challenge. Explaining the peculiar marks on JonBenet's body that Lou Smith had convincingly argued were consistent with a stun gun. Advocates of the Burke theory have attempted to address this. The best explanation they've offered is that these marks were not from a stun gun, but were instead stab marks made from sections of Burke's metal model train rail segments. This theory, while imaginative, struggled to gain serious traction among professionals in the field. This alternative explanation was investigated by a British medical investigator who found the train track theory to be, quote, "borderline fanciful at best." This assessment speaks to the challenges of constructing a plausible narrative that fits all the known facts of the case. The stun gun theory, supported by Lou Smith's extensive research and demonstration, seemed to align more closely with the evidence at hand. As we continue to navigate the murky waters of this case, we encounter various theories and claims, some more credible than others. Among these is the allegation of prior sexual abuse, a claim that has been a focal point of the investigation and public speculation. However, new information emerged in 1998 that offered a different perspective, potentially challenging this aspect of the case. JonBenet's former pediatrician stepped forward with critical insights. He recounted that JonBenet had been brought to him several times prior to her murder with symptoms of vaginitis. Now, vaginitis in children is not uncommon. It can stem from various benign causes, including irritation from soap or other everyday factors. The pediatrician's account suggested a simple, non-nefarious explanation for the symptoms noted in JonBenet's autopsy. The pediatrician emphasized the importance of recognizing signs of sexual abuse in his profession. He was adamant that, in his professional judgment, he had seen no indications of such abuse in JonBenet. This testimony was significant, casting doubt on one of the most disturbing aspects of the case. A pathologist in Colorado Springs and an expert on abused children re-examined the autopsy evidence and arrived at a similar conclusion. The findings of chronic vaginal inflammation, which had fueled these theories of sexual abuse, were, in his view, being overinterpreted. He asserted that making leaps to conclusions of guilt based on these findings was, quote, not based on science. In 2016, for an A&E special on the case, a member of the Boulder Police was confronted with this new information. He admitted that he had been unaware of JonBenet's treatment for vaginitis and expressed surprise that this detail had never been shared with him during the investigation. His reaction underscored a critical issue in the case: the potential for significant information to be overlooked or underemphasized. In the puzzle that is the JonBenet case, the timeline of events on the night of her murder are crucial, particularly when it comes to the theories posited by the Denver police. Their case against the parents hinges on this: the idea that JonBenet was struck on the head, rendering her unconscious, long before the other aspects of the crime, like the staging of the kidnapping and the placing of the garrote around her neck. According to this theory, the head blow was the initial act, and everything that followed was an elaborate cover-up. But here's where science clearly challenges this narrative. The autopsy revealed telling details around the ligature marks on JonBenet's neck from the garrote: small, C-shaped bruises and scratch marks. They weren't just random injuries. They were self-inflicted, caused by JonBenet's own fingernails as she desperately tried to free herself from the garrote. These marks tell a story of a child who was alive and conscious during this brutal part of the attack. This is a critical piece of evidence. If JonBenet had been rendered unconscious by the head blow, as initially theorized by the police, these defensive marks would not exist. The very presence of these marks tells us that the sequence of events proposed by the police doesn't align with the physical evidence. The injuries speak for themselves, painting a narrative that fundamentally undermines the Boulder police's theory. The garroting, a horrifying aspect of this crime, could not have been a post-incident staging to cover up an accidental killing within the family. This realization is significant. It not only challenges the prevailing theory, but also opens up the investigation to other possibilities, other sequences of events that might align more closely with the physical evidence. In this complex and tragic case, the physical evidence provides a voice to JonBenet, a way to piece together the story of her final moments. But in this instance, that evidence points away from the theory of an accidental killing followed by a staged crime scene. It's a powerful reminder of the importance of following the science, of letting the evidence guide the investigation rather than fitting the evidence into a preconceived narrative. But die-hard followers of this case will likely have one more question that's still burning in their minds, one that the Boulder police have hung nearly their entire case on. But what about the pineapple? This piece of evidence has sparked numerous theories and debates, particularly regarding its implications for the involvement of JonBenet's family in the events of that night. A bowl of pineapple, found on the Ramsey's dining room table, becomes a significant piece of the puzzle when autopsy reports reveal that pineapple was the last thing JonBenet ate before her death. None of the Ramseys admitted to preparing or giving her the pineapple, contradicting their initial statement that JonBenet was carried asleep from the car and put straight to bed on the night of her death. The presence of pineapple in her stomach suggests that she must have been awake at some point after returning home. Further complicating this is the discovery of fingerprints belonging to Patsy and Burke Ramsey on the pineapple bowl. This detail has fueled the theory that JonBenet and her brother Burke may have gotten up together in the middle of the night, as pineapple was known to be Burke's favorite snack. The interview with Burke Ramsey years later added to the speculation, as some perceived his response to being shown a photo of the pineapple on the table as suspicious.
Can you tell me what this picture is?
The dining room table.
Yeah, that's the one that's
missing.
Can you describe that to me?
It's a bowl
However, it's important to note that no conclusive physical evidence directly ties Burke to the crime. The Ramseys maintained that Burke was in his room all night, and there was no physical evidence to contradict this. The fingerprints on the bowl, while intriguing, don't definitively prove involvement in the crime, as time cannot be attributed to fingerprints. In the broader context of the case, the pineapple evidence presents yet another layer of mystery. It challenges us to consider the family dynamics, the events of that night, and the possible scenarios that could have led to JonBenet consuming the pineapple. This detail, like so many in this case, raises more questions than it answers, leaving us to ponder the many possible narratives that could explain what happened to JonBenet Ramsey. In the years following JonBenet's death, a perplexing and disturbing trend emerged. Various individuals came forward, claiming responsibility for her murder. Who were these individuals? They varied widely in background and motivation. Some were attention seekers, drawn to the notoriety of the case. Others were troubled souls, perhaps dealing with mental health issues, who had become inexplicably entangled in the narrative of the murder. In some cases, these individuals seemed to seek a strange sort of infamy by associating themselves with one of the most high-profile crimes in recent memory. But why confess to such a heinous crime if one is innocent? The psychology behind false confessions can be complex. It ranges from a desire for notoriety to a misguided sense of guilt or even coercion. In the context of the Ramsey case, these confessions often seem to be cries for attention. Desperate acts by individuals seeking a moment in the spotlight, however dark and twisted that spotlight might be. So how were these confessions ruled out? Forensic evidence, especially DNA evidence, played a critical role. The unidentified male DNA found on JonBenet's clothing has been a key piece of evidence in excluding these self-proclaimed perpetrators. Additionally, inconsistencies in their stories, lack of knowledge about key details of the crime, and sometimes clear evidence that they could not have been at the crime scene, all served to discredit these claims. In a case as high profile as JonBenet's murder, it's perhaps not surprising that it attracted false confessions. Yet each time someone stepped forward claiming responsibility, there was a flicker of hope that the case might finally be solved, only for it to be extinguished by the stark light of evidence and fact. In the JonBenet Ramsey case, The journey through the facts and evidence often intersects with a more ethereal path, one that ventures into the world of the paranormal and the spiritual. These stories, anecdotes, and experiences, while not grounded in scientific evidence as we've seen in true crime, offer a different lens through which to view the case, perhaps providing insights into the unseen and the unexplained. They also speak to the enduring impact of JonBenet's story on the collective consciousness. Let's explore a few of these accounts, starting with an experience from 2014 shared by a 19-year-old college student. In their new dorm-style apartment, they befriended a roommate who displayed a psychic connection. One night, after a series of lively college gatherings, the roommate abruptly declared, "They're coming," and identified one of the arrivals as JonBenet. Seconds later, two young women then entered the scene, one bearing a striking resemblance to an older version of JonBenet. The encounter left the students in shock, particularly when their roommate casually mentioned that one of the girls was JonBenet Ramsey. This eerie incident, with its inexplicable elements and the profound effect it had on those involved, adds a mysterious layer to JonBenet's legacy. In another instance, just a few years ago, two friends, experimenting with a Ouija board, decided to reach out to JonBenet's spirit. Skeptical yet intrigued, they asked questions about her well-being and her killer. Suddenly, they heard the unmistakable giggle of a little girl, a sound so clear and distinct that it left them all terrified. This experience, ending with the pendulum moving back to the middle of the board by itself, adds to this enigma. These stories, among others, offer a glimpse into the way JonBenet's memory continues to resonate with people. In my experience, ghosts, in a broader sense, might be memories that implore us not to forget, to learn from the past and carry those lessons forward. In the case of JonBenet Ramsey, her spirit, whether perceived through paranormal encounters or kept alive in the hearts and minds of those who remember her, serves as this kind of reminder. While these stories might not provide concrete answers to the case, they contribute to the tapestry of JonBenet's story, a narrative that clearly transcends the physical world. Another experience shared by an individual delves into a dream encounter with JonBenet. In this vivid dream, the person found themselves walking through the Ramsey house, guided by a gentle, childlike presence. They described feeling an overwhelming sense of sadness and longing, as if the spirit of JonBenet was attempting to communicate something crucial about her untimely demise. Upon waking, the dreamer felt an unshakable connection to the case, a deep empathy for JonBenet that transcended the boundaries of time and space. Similarly, a medium recounted a seance where they claimed to have contacted JonBenet's spirit. In this otherworldly communication, the medium described JonBenet's presence as both sorrowful and serene, her spirit still seeking peace and justice. The attendees of the seance reported feeling a palpable change in the atmosphere, a sense of a young life cut tragically short, but still resonating with those who seek to understand her story. These encounters with the spiritual echo of JonBenet remind us of the case's emotional depth. They suggest that JonBenet's spirit, in whatever form it may exist, continues to impact those who remember her. These experiences also speak to the human desire to connect with the past, to find meaning in tragedy, and to seek answers in the unknown. Reflecting on these paranormal accounts, we are drawn to consider the larger implications of such experiences. They compel us to ponder the mysteries of the afterlife and the ways in which the spirits of those who have passed on might continue to influence the living. In the context of the JonBenet Ramsey case, these stories offer a form of solace, a way to engage with a tragedy that has left so many unanswered questions. We are reminded that the line between the physical and the spiritual world is often blurred, especially in cases as emotionally charged and enigmatic as JonBenet's. These stories, while they may not provide the answers we seek about her death, offer a different kind of insight, one that speaks to the enduring impact of her life and the collective desire to remember and honor her. As we draw to the close of this episode, exploring the deep, intricate layers of the JonBenet Ramsey case, we find ourselves not just at the end of a story, but at the beginning of understanding. Throughout our journey tonight, we've traversed the stark realities of a heartbreaking crime, the complexities of an investigation riddled with more questions than answers, and the ethereal realm of the paranormal that this case has touched upon. So why does any of this matter? Why are we drawn to stories like JonBenet's? In grappling with these questions, we confront not just the specifics of a single tragic case, but the broader truths about our world, our societies, and ourselves. The JonBenet Ramsey case isn't just a story of a family's unspeakable loss. It's yet again another mirror reflecting our collective fears, our search for justice, and our fascination with the unknown. This case, with its myriad theories, its unexplainable details, and its haunting legacy, embodies the very essence of When Walls Can Talk. Here, at the intersection of paranormal mysteries and dark histories, we find stories that challenge us, that compel us to question, and that remind us of the fragility and complexity of life. In these stories, we see reflections of our own lives, our own mysteries. We are reminded that the world is full of unanswered questions and unresolved histories, and it's our curiosity, our need to understand, that drives us to keep exploring. In the words of Rainer Maria Rilke, "Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart, and try to love the answers themselves." Perhaps it's in embracing the questions, rather than seeking definitive answers, that we find the true meaning in stories like JonBenet. As we conclude, I leave you with this thought. In every mystery, every unexplained phenomenon, there's an opportunity to reflect on the human condition, on the ways we connect with each other, and on our endless quest to understand the unseen forces that shape our world. What lessons can we take from JonBenet's story? How does it challenge us to think about justice, about the paranormal, and about the way we navigate our complex modern world? Thank you for joining me on this journey through one of the most haunting and enduring mysteries of our time. May we carry forward not just the memory of JonBenet Ramsey, but a renewed sense of curiosity and empathy as we navigate the stories and mysteries that await us.